Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Diane Finkhausen, a global leader building and reinventing organizations at the intersection of ecosystemic transformation, innovation, and digital industry. As our world is becoming increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we innovate and build for the future. In this podcast series, we're exploring these new ecosystemic impacts across every facet of society, from the future of education, work, agriculture, engineering, tech, aviation, and space, to name just a few. Today, we'll be discussing the economic value of cities, how their evolvement can foster innovation and growth, and the positive economic impacts of this transformation. I'm thrilled to be joined by my co-host, Vic Shyam.
Thanks, Diane. Happy to host or co-host today. Vic, been at NASA for 15 years. I'm currently working as a futurist for the Convergent Aeronautic Solutions Project. I have a background in propulsion, biomimicry, and foresight. And today I'm very interested in learning more from Tom about how cities will help connect people, provide healthcare, address issues related to sustainability and the climate. Very important and relevant topic for today. So welcome, Tom. Could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, Vic. Thanks. And hello, Diane. My name's Tom Cheesewright. I'm an applied futurist based in the UK. I work with organizations around the world to try to help them to see the future more clearly and work out what to do about it with some storytelling along the way.
Thank you all so much for joining. What an exciting topic. And this one is so relevant given the rapidly evolving innovations, technologies, and changes in the world today. So let's dive in. And Vic, I know we have a few kind of framing considerations to kind of set the stage for the conversation. So Vic, over to you.
Thanks, Diane. Yeah, very often people talk about cities, but we're not quite sure what we mean by them and why we have these things. So going back to our ancestors, maybe the quick cave dwellers, and how did we end up here? So Tom, just for us lay people, can you define why we live in cities, what they are? What kind of cities are you talking about?
It's a really good question, especially to someone based here in the UK where I am, where the gift of city status is still in the hands of our monarch. So not directly the king, but basically the king decides if a particular size of community is or is not a city. I mean, historically, it's been around a place with a cathedral. And I think that's quite indicative of what we mean by a city in the modern sense. It's about a self-contained place to some extent that has this array of services, of capabilities, of communities, and operates at a certain scale as well. And I think primarily when we're talking about cities for the future and the long-term survival rate and the evolution of the city, I think we have to be focused on those at the larger end of the scale, the big metro areas that are hubs for commerce, that are hubs for local government. So, I mean, yeah, I wouldn't like to put an exact scale number on it, but probably north of 1 million people, if not north of 2 million for the larger cities.
Super helpful, Tom. And maybe if we double click into that, let's talk about the future of cities and those big cities. Are they dying? Are they diminishing? Or what does their reinvention look like? And whose responsibility is it?
It's a really good question. The idea that cities are dying is like so many trends, like so many ideas, a cyclical one. It's one that goes away and comes back, and it happens in different places at different times with different environmental and economic drivers. So you can look at all of the stories about Detroit back in sort of the early 2010s, 2013, and the bankruptcy, all sorts of headlines about the death of a city and where it's all gone wrong and why are people even still living there. And then fast forward a decade, and there's all these stories about rebirth and reinvention and reinvigoration and how it's a sort of a great case study of the enduring nature of cities and that ability for us to restore them based on something fundamental about them, this sort of connected humanity that's at their core. Again, we've had this through the pandemic, which was another spur for conversations about the death of the city. Lots of people, particularly at certain stages in their life, deciding during the COVID pandemic that they didn't want to be in a city. They didn't want to be surrounded by other people, that empowered by a new openness to more flexible ways of working, they could escape the city and move to a more beautiful place, perhaps a more rural place with a different quality of life. And many did. So we saw shifts in house prices, massive increases in house prices in some of the most attractive places to live around the world that were at least nearby cities that people could commute back into some days of the week. And so again, we had all these headlines about the death of the city. And I remember thinking at the time that that was pretty unsustainable, that there were some foundational important reasons why we created cities in the first place, and it would take more than a pandemic, a laptop and a broadband connection to kill them off. And I actually wrote an article for a collected book called Aftershocks and Opportunities at the time, called Snapback, about how all the sort of elastic forces that draw us into cities are likely to pull us back there over time. And sure enough, post-pandemic, we're seeing more and more headlines about companies returning to old ways of working, asking people to be back in the office, return to footfall in shopping centres, not at necessarily pre-pandemic levels yet, certainly an acceleration of the long-term trend towards more flexible working, but not also a complete abandonment of the city. And I think that's because they do something fundamental for us. They do something fundamental for us as human beings, for us as corporations, for us as governmental institutions. And yeah, I think we'll certainly talk about that. These are the things that give them their life, that give them their soul, that give them their need for being. And also define, when we're thinking about future cities, who's going to have to take responsibility for their evolution and their development.
Tom, can I just go back to the, you mentioned people are escaping cities or were escaping cities, especially during the pandemic. Was that a relatively small percentage of people? And is that why it's unsustainable? Or were there other reasons?
So it was unsustainable for a number of reasons, partly because they all wanted to move to the same places. And those places are relatively small communities. And they're only beautiful and attractive small communities because they're relatively small communities. The moment that you start to wholesale relocate the city to the coast or to the very particular pretty bit of coast, it stops being that particular pretty bit of coast. But absolutely, it was a certain demographic that were doing it. It was a certain demographic that happened to be quite influential with the media, and so it got an awful lot of attention. But primarily, it was people who were at a life stage where they had enough career security to demand that capability to work remotely, to only visit the office certain amounts of time. They had a level of wealth that meant they could afford to move and maybe retain a sort of pied-à-terre in the city that they could return to for work and spend a couple of days a week in. And it meant that they quite often, if they had children, their children were at an age where they could move without being disadvantaged. Because we all know that when they hit their teenage years or when they reach their college years, those children are almost certainly going to want to move back into the city again, because that was what we do to restart the cycle. It's where we go to meet people. It's where we go to find work. It's where we go to find ourselves and have new experiences. It is that culture, that dense cultural hub that creates all of those opportunities.
Yeah, I was curious about what the implications are for transportation in that setting. We see a lot of really interesting innovation in the transportation space. And given that dynamic, Tom, what are the implications for transportation and for people as the system of cities or the ecosystem of cities is evolving?
I think you have to look at lots of different types of transportation here. I think intra-city transportation, so the ability to move around a city quickly and efficiently, is very interesting. Whether it is mass transit or new forms of personal electric transport, the ability to move around cities, particularly as cities grow, we do have some extraordinarily large cities now, which are themselves really ecosystems of what would have been smaller cities in the past. The ability to get around those, particularly as they start to develop quite sort of heterogeneous natures, where you get different districts with different appeals, different cultural attractions, the ability to move around quickly and efficiently is really important. And we're seeing a lot of innovation in that space. But then there's also the intra-city transport. And however self-sufficient a city might appear to be, it's always going to need connections with both other cities in the same country, other cities on the same continent, other cities around the world, and actually places that aren't cities as well, whether that is for commuters who want to be there for certain parts of the week, people getting back to their families, or people going out for leisure pursuits as well. Do I want to go and experience something that only exists in another city? Do I want to get beyond the city for something? So that sort of extra city transport is really interesting as well. And as you look at transport across all of those dimensions, I think we're seeing, well, we are either seeing or we can see coming very rapid innovation in all of those. So the intra-city transport, we've got very interesting things happening with these sort of personal electric devices, the possibility for limited domain autonomous vehicles. For the intra-city and extra-city, some of these smaller flying vehicles, I do a lot of work with property owners and property developers who are already planning for landing pads for these sort of passenger drone type devices in future commercial property developments in cities. And then that sort of extra city, whether that is the longer range, more completely autonomous class 5 autonomous vehicles, which may be 15, 20 years out, or new mass transit options, a lot more electrification, lots of faster travel in terms of trains, etc. All sorts of innovation happening there. Perhaps slowed by the general global cost of living crisis and an unwillingness of governments to invest in infrastructure in certain parts of the world at the moment. But yeah, I think the implications for transport are huge, but not negative.
Might it be possible to recreate some of the value of these cities? When you talk about transport, some of those services might actually be offloaded by, let's say, new technology that's coming up, or AI, or let's say people living in virtual worlds, or the future, whatever these metaverses might be. But is it possible for some of that, the roles of transportation in current cities, to be offloaded in that direction? And I had another related question. So you mentioned the elasticity of cities and people being pulled back into big cities, counter trend to the pandemic. What if we look at it differently and say, let's say we have these distributed services, could you actually spur the growth of new cities? So say we encourage people to migrate and then relieve some of the resource burdens locally by having people more distributed.
So there's two aspects I'd really like to take out of that. One is this possibility for sort of smaller distributed cities, like an ecosystem of smaller cities. And one is about this piece around the metaverse and digital connectivity and the role of AI. Starting with that ecosystem approach, there's really interesting data out of the Open Data Institute looking at the power of connectivity to drive productivity. So it doesn't matter so much whether you're in the same city as long as you can reach other economic actors, economic locations. If you can bring down the cost and the time cost of travel, you can drive incredible economic gains, economic benefits. And so could we do that with a network of smaller cities? I think absolutely. The reality of our historical development is that quite often you get a sort of hub city and then smaller cities around it. But those smaller cities are quite often locked out of some of the economic benefits of the larger metro hub. Better transport options absolutely opens up the economic benefits and the access to services and culture from that larger core to that network of cities, and inversely turns those smaller cities into much more attractive places to live for people who feel economically bound or culturally bound to the larger core. And because quite often those cities, particularly where I live, I mean, Greater Manchester in the north of England, we have Manchester at the core, and then this surrounding array of smaller cities which have access to incredible facilities like points of natural beauty, or beautiful historical buildings being converted into accommodation, or their own sort of cultural propositions. If we could better connect those cities into this holistic ecosystem, then yeah, it would be incredibly powerful. And I do think that works, but largely due to historical reasons, unless we are starting from scratch, you're more likely to have a sort of hub city at the core. But I think we can do a much better job of including those smaller cities in the surroundings. In terms of the metaverse and the digital piece, I'm a strong believer, and I think we can see evidence of this again from the pandemic and actually even before, that the more digitally connected we are, the more our communications are mediated by technology, the greater the hunger we have for things that are physical and real and visceral, whether that is human relationships, whether that is great food, whether that is the great outdoors. And again, here in the UK, during lockdown, two really interesting things happened. First of all, a quarter of us took up hiking. There was this deep-seated need to get out into nature and see trees and breathe the air and walk the coastal paths. And also we bought something like 3 million pets as well. So we wanted something warm and cuddly and real around us, when so many of our interactions were just had this dirty great screen between us that isolated us. And so I think as we shift into this world of, I do think the metaverse as a form of mixed reality communication is likely to become our primary digital interface in the next decade or so. I think it won't diminish demand for connection, for travel, for human interaction. I think it will actually increase it. And what I mean by that is we may not do it as much. We may decide that some things are better done in the metaverse, but we will want incredibly high quality from the interactions that we do have. We will want them to be rich. We will want them to be exciting. I think things like extreme sports are likely to go through a renaissance. I think our demand when we eat out, our expectations will be higher and higher. And I think we'll want to get together physically with people as a counterpoint to those digital experiences.
I love this concept of the potential kind of distribution democratization of cities, right? An ecosystem of cities enabled through the advances in technologies and models. So and how that might in fact elevate the premium for physical experiences and relationships. It's a fascinating concept. And if we think about the networking of cities and both the economic and intrinsic value of that can unlock, how do we redesign cities and who does that? And how does that definition change over time? Does that concept and ownership of city planning evolve and shift as well?
Yeah, I think in order to answer that, we have to look at why we want cities. And I've talked about it to a certain extent about that. The user demand, what you might call, why do people want to be citizens? It's because of that connection. It's that economic opportunity. It's that social opportunity. We like to be around other people and the things that other people are doing. But there's also some really sort of hard services answers to why cities. We want to be close to the things that we need in a modern world. We want to be close to doctors' surgeries, to banks, to schools. And those things are most available in a city, at least in a well-designed city. And flipping that on its head, as you look at the need from governments to provide those things to citizens, actually, in a world where we have an aging population who are presenting greater demands on those services, where we have some quite serious economic challenges around whether the tax base can support us all. Governments need cities because they're the most economically efficient place to deliver services. It's much easier to support people, particularly people in need, if you don't have to travel a long way, if you can service a lot of people with the same infrastructure, if you can keep an eye on people, and I don't mean that in a big brother sense, but in a services sense, without having to do it across a very large geographic area. So there's this big demand from a governmental perspective to maintain and evolve cities. And then thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, there's the environmental demand. You know, cities are relatively, for a modern population, the most efficient way to live. Our energy requirements, both for travel and for heating, are much lower in cities. We can do things like water reclamation. Yes, there are huge issues around sort of water not being absorbed back into the earth and the excess stored heat and things. But ultimately, cities are a much more efficient way for us to live at the population size and scale that we are now than us being much more distributed around in rural areas where we have very high energy costs for heating and transport and food, etc. And so for all of those reasons, all of those drivers, A, we need cities, but B, we need those cities to evolve. And I think that the answer in terms of who's going to be responsible is going to change from country to country. It will depend on our political systems. It will depend on our levels of wealth. It will depend on our motivations. But it's going to have to be a collaboration. And what's a great example of this? We're not going to see in a lot of places perhaps the level of state investment in transport infrastructure we might like to, because they will argue that the money just isn't there at the moment because of the levels of disruption that might be required to institute new forms of mass transit are very difficult. But actually, you can see local authorities creating the space for innovation in more personal forms of transport, ultimately perhaps less efficient, perhaps less environmentally friendly, but at least it's away from some of the current forms. Progress away from the car as the default. And cities can create, governments can create space for innovation, those things in cities, and allow a sort of side-by-side cooperation between the individual, the corporation, and the government. So I think that's where some of the most exciting stuff's happening at the moment, albeit it remains embryonic, looking at stats around use of personal transport in cities, there's still a lot of issues there, whether that is around streets being blocked by unused or by whether it's the form factor of the forms of transport itself being unsuitable for certain weather conditions, whether it's just the sheer injuries happening from sometimes drunken people using some of these electric forms of public transport.
So you mentioned something about this has to be collaborative, and you mentioned the role of local authorities and the design aspect of cities. I'm wondering, it's a bit of a chicken or the egg to me, because so you can design a city for certain needs, but that's a snapshot of time. But then it can end up having behavioral consequences on populations. So you think about, in the US, for example, the preference for cars versus mass transport. There's been a shift over the last century, or over the last century, there was a shift, and now we're again considering high-speed rail and that kind of stuff. So the ways that cities are designed, whether it's zoning or how you design you mentioned the hub and spoke model, how you design that, it's not homogenous around the world. And so who's involved in making these decisions? How are these cities designed? Is it the citizens? Is there a greater need that comes into it? And how do you make sure that they're future-proof?
I think your future-proof is always an ambition. Completely future-proof is probably unachievable. But the way we do it is working with futurists like you and me, Vic. So one of the cities I worked with, for example, tasked us to imagine multiple scenarios for that city 30 years hence and to lay out scenarios based on different ambitions. So if we were going to try to maximize economic growth, if we were going to try and even out inequality, if we were going to try to maximize environmental performance, what would the interventions be? What would the city look like in those scenarios? Where would the hot spots and the cold spots in terms of wealth and inequality be, in terms of carbon emissions? You can lay out some of those different possibilities and imagine your response in each of those circumstances. And obviously, I'm not saying they all have to pay me to help them with it, but I would encourage all cities to do that foresight. And in our case, it was a really interesting exercise because it did draw on the expertise from people across the city. We had representatives of passenger groups, we had representatives from business, we had representatives from health and care, from different segments of the population, from different pieces of government, from law enforcement, all feeding into what happens in these different scenarios and how would we respond. It's an expensive exercise. It's a time-consuming exercise, but I think an invaluable exercise at the same time. And now, it's even sort of 10 years later, we're seeing the fruits of that exercise in terms of transport planning for that city and the rollout of things like bike lanes, like new tram lines, like changes in the way that buses are regulated in order to create the sort of provision that the city needed to optimize against those different priorities of equality, economic growth, and environmental performance. So there are methodologies, there are processes that you can follow to maybe not completely future-proof. Pandemics were not in any of the exercises that we ran back then. But in terms of laying out different possibilities and trying to plot the optimum path that helps you meet all of those objectives.
You brought up foresight, and I like the notion of thinking about the future and involving as many people as possible in these decisions. And it brings to mind trade-offs. And so how important is this in decision-making? So when you think about designing a city for economic incentives, it could be short-term, but it could end up increasing inequities in the future. So when we talked about the metaverse and enabling remote cities and distributed cities and such, very often it's the people who are, you mentioned the demographics, the high skill, the people with laptops. So how often are the people not included in those categories brought in these discussions?
I mean, I think in our case, we did a reasonable job of that. You can always do better. But for me, there's something really interesting happening with my clients over the last few years. And I work across the corporate sector with mostly sort of global 500 firms, but also in the government sector and actually in the third sector as well with charities and NGOs. And I found a really weird alignment of objectives coming across all three, where shocked by the impact of things like climate change, by war on their supply chains, on their access to things like talent. A lot of business leaders have shifted their horizons much further out. And so the short term, even if they are sort of listed companies with very specific short-term objectives in terms of growth, I found a lot of business leaders going back to their shareholders and pushing back to their boards and saying, actually, we're in a very volatile environment in the short term now. The best thing I can do is establish the ground rules, the structures for long-term success of this organization. And when they do that, what we're finding is that their objectives become very well aligned with the objectives with a lot of the rest of the population, with government, with citizens. And so a lot of that sort of short-termism goes away. And I even heard a hedge fund manager tell me this. And when a hedge fund manager tells you that they're focused on the long term and that they're pushing their investments to be more focused on the long term, because something has changed quite radically. And so I think that that's really interesting. The macro pressures that we're facing and the need to respond to them are very well understood now by a lot of different stakeholders. And so they are shifting the horizon on which they're focused. And they are taking what you might historically have seen as more certainly responsible, if not altruistic, decisions about what those plans should look like.
Great points. And actually, to further to that point, I think what we're all advocating here is a more systemic kind of planning and like monitoring of the potential futures and kind of reading what's in the landscape today and looking to the pathways that those trends and observations could instigate. And I think we're seeing a kind of a natural shift in both private sector and public sector planning models. And we're seeing regularly and perhaps increasingly early functions that have traditionally been led by the public realm shifting into the governance of the private realm. And how should we be thinking about coordinating this shift, ensuring that both long-term and short-term, that the design for ecosystemic wellness is maintained and not subverted really to the interests of any specific private institution or sector? Do we think those private markets are efficient enough to adapt to and anticipate ecosystemic responses?
So my problem with them is not so much efficiency, it is longevity. Mm-hmm. And so many of the investments that we need to be making right now are things that might only have a 30-year return. And even with a lot of corporations starting to think slightly more long-term for them is 5, 7, 10 years. Often it's not 25, 30, 40, 50 years. And really, there's only two constituencies that can operate at that sort of range. One of them is governments, who can borrow money very cheaply, can think in the long term. But without being in any way sort of party political about it, the general tenor of political debate is in many ways out of sync with the rest of the world thinking more long, because we've had this very rapid turnover of populations and ideas and political philosophies as well. And naturally, a lot of politicians are focused on ensuring that they get elected at the next election, rather than necessarily instituting plans that might prove optimal over the very long term. So we've got some work to do there. But this other constituency, I think, is really interesting, which is collectives of the general public in one way or another. And coming together through open source movements, through community groups, through sort of long-term community interest companies and other establishments that create a system of shared ownership, of shared responsibility. And we're seeing this in everything from, you know, football clubs, soccer clubs in US parlance, to local amenities like markets and libraries, to not transport infrastructure yet, but I don't think it's beyond the bounds of possibility. And I think that third group, which in many ways existed and predated a lot of local and national government, to the sorts of emergence of cooperatives and sort of shared financial groups that ultimately got rolled into the state in many places, I think we're seeing those groups re-emerge, but with a much broader set of capabilities and interests, and really empowered by technology to take a lot of the friction out of doing that collaborative work. And certainly, you know, I've seen great examples of that near me and through charitable institutions to take on things that perhaps the state has retreated from, where private ownership wouldn't be optimal for the main customers of that service.
So we spoke about the stakeholders in terms of who builds these cities, who designs these, the decision makers. But in terms of the actual utility of it, we're starting to see things like biophilia, the mental health of people in cities. You mentioned the role of transportation. Very often the issue with people driving, like road rage, all these things, you've insulated yourself. There's this push towards bringing the natural elements into cities. Do you see other kinds of innovation in design that are more compatible with, let's say, health, sustainability and such?
So one of the ones I'm a bit obsessed with, and whether you call it design or not, I don't know. But over the last few years, we've become much more relaxed about where people work. And yet we're still very obsessed with when people work. We still seem to be doing possibly the least efficient thing possible for productivity and for infrastructure, which is encouraging everybody to move around the city at exactly the same time. And I think that's going to have to change. I think we're going to see a real redesign of the working day, both to take account of the fact that people have different body clocks. Some people are very naturally early risers, are super productive at 6 o'clock in the morning, but really run out of steam by 2 p.m. And some people naturally might not start until midday, but would very happily work until 10 o'clock in the evening. And we're going to make people an awful lot healthier and happier, and we're going to need to overspec our infrastructure an awful lot less if we start to accommodate that flexibility. We have so many good forms of asynchronous communication now that the idea that we all have to be at the office at the exact same time for all of the same hours seems absolutely ridiculous. And so one of the really big, useful redesigns that we could do for me would be to open up to a much more flexible working day in terms of hours and build our operational systems, both for the city and for the individual organizations, around that flexibility.
So given this flexibility that we might end up designing for it, it seems like there's a lot of people talking about reusing existing city infrastructure as a way of sustainability. Is that what's going to happen to all these like large commercial properties that are being built up right now? Are they just going to be spare parts for some future manufacturing or transportation or whatever happens?
I mean, there's two aspects to that. One is reusing the things that we've already built today, quite often inefficiently with very poor use of raw materials, a lot of concrete buildings that we don't get an awful lot of value from if we tear them down. And you're already seeing that. I think one of the really interesting trends of the last decade has been the rapid repurposing of commercial and retail properties into residential. It's the sort of non-hipster continuation of turning banks into wine bars and coffee shops. It's turning office blocks into residential apartments. And it's required a shift in planning law. It doesn't always necessarily result in the nicest places to live, but it has created some relatively cheap places to live when there is a shortage in a very overheated market. I think we'll see a lot more of that. In the long run, though, we can do an awful lot better in terms of building infrastructure with reusability and recycling in mind. And so one of my clients is a large steel manufacturer. They're very interested in how we could standardize the steel components of buildings, so that rather than being melted down and recast, they can actually just be unbolted and reused with a fresh coat of paint. And that, I think, is a really interesting idea. Much more modularity in our construction, much more flexibility. Building both with the understanding that we might want to change the use of a building, we might want to change the size of a building, but actually we might want to remove that building altogether and put something else on its site.
So if we think about the shifting focus to ecosystems, right? And the big city, the kind of a contrast to ecosystemic networks of cities. How should we be thinking about the ultimate kind of shift to the ideal infrastructure for humanity and the connected infrastructure for humanity? What is the right balance, and how should we be thinking about that design, and who should participate in that design from your perspective?
Yeah, I think it's a question that's hard to answer without shifting into some level of ideology, because there are so many options in front of us and you have to have some sense of what the ideal is. But you can pick up some interesting things from the trends in the way that we live. We are living, we're spending a lot more time in what you might call our extended adolescence. And so we're quite often not doing things like buying a house, learning to drive, having a car, getting married, having kids, until well into our 30s. And so you've got cohort now sort of to 30 who are experiencing cities one way. And we have to build cities that accommodate those people, that allow them to live lives of quite high flexibility in terms of their working patterns, in terms of their living patterns, high demand for engagement. And then another group of people, again, another growing cohort in the population, will be those of retirement age. And the retirement age is probably going to increase, but ideally, with a lot of the medical interventions over the next 20 years, people living very long, healthy lives, well beyond their 60s, into their 70s, into their 80s, and ideally into their 90s and even beyond. What does a city look like for that cohort that's ideal, that again provides them with the cultural offering, the social engagement, the access to services that those people need and desire? And then in between that, you've got your sort of for your families. Obviously, not everyone's going to have a family, but the other obvious cohort is families and children. Can we create cities that allow those people to live in a relatively dense fashion with access to the services that they want and need, that allows us to support that group in both a economically efficient fashion from a governmental perspective, but also an environmentally efficient fashion from the wider climate response perspective? And so, yeah, I think if you start to look at those three primary cohorts and then feed into that the demands on them in terms of economic performance, environmental performance, and in some ways, and this is how we measure this, is remains a source of great contention, but some measure of quality of life as well. We could just stick everybody in little boxes that are very, very efficient, but we don't really want to do that. You know, some measure of quality of life, particularly around the diversity of cities and the diversity of offer, the diversity of people, the diversity of choice, the diversity of economic proposition and work opportunity. Yeah, I think all of those things would be generally accepted by people of any political ideology as important priorities. And they might, when considered as a whole, drive us in particular directions from a decision-making point of view. But again, I think the answer is going to be different for every city. I think it's going to be different for every community. It's going to be different for every country, based on relative levels of wealth, availability of investment, and the dominant political ideology of the day.
Speaking of these different types of, you mentioned the demographics, the different types of cities and who they're suited for, we're hearing a lot of people talking about flying hotels or space hotels, space tourism, and we're talking about colonizing Mars and the moon. Are there services that you think might be provided by these kinds of transportation, whether it's airships or space hotels? Do you see some role there in terms of terrestrial cities? And then conversely, are there any things we can transfer to our colonization of outer space that we've learned from cities so we don't need to start from scratch?
So I'm more convinced by floating cities than flying cities. I think there's enormous opportunity to make better use of our non-land mass, if you like, and to do stuff out on the water. And given the enormous amounts of, I mean, just waste, could we reuse waste raw materials, not dump them in the ocean, but use them, and again, not to sort of disrupt ecosystems, but actually to create quite synergistic cities that exist out in the ocean, particularly if we are starting to migrate towards space. And the idea that we're going to move into space in a large-scale fashion using current rocket technology seems unlikely to me. It's however much we've brought down the cost per kilo of moving things and people into space, it's still very expensive, both economically and environmentally. One of the great opportunities out in the middle of the ocean would be to do something like a space elevator at some point. Still enormous technical challenges to be overcome. But the ability to move up and down to space, albeit slowly, but at scale, I think is really, really interesting and does give humanity the opportunity to expand into space and make better use of the opportunities there, whether they are in terms of high quality manufacturing, whether it is access to new resources, access to new planets, or just the simple desire to expand. A lot of people I know have concerns about us sort of moving like locusts, like some character from a science fiction, from planet to planet. But given that the relative lack of evidence of other intelligent life out there right now, I do feel a certain imperative on humanity to go and explore and see these things and bring intelligent life to the universe, and starting with bringing it to our orbit, but just probably not with an awful lot of rockets.
Building a bridge to space would be the answer. That's So a lot of our knowledge of construction, of sustainability, these services might be transferred first to getting us to space, making that connection rather than living there.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah.
I love that concept of synergistic cities. And there's so much that we can learn and bring to that journey, right? So
we've made an awful lot of mistakes along the way. We can learn from those.
Yeah, I mean, we should learn from those, right? Those were investments in a better path forward. So yeah, with that, I think we're going to need to wrap it there. What a great discussion. I walked away with a few, I think, really important ahas and things from this discussion. I love the concept of thinking about cities through the lens of reinvention and rebirth. Really, as we think about the impact of cities on ecosystemic wellness, right? Synergistic cities enabled through thoughtful design for transportation, systems design and innovation. And no doubt the structure of cities will continue to impact the ecosystems of the future. And then also, Tom, rethinking cities as the ultimate embodiment of connected humanity, the potential shift in city and work planning systems for a more distributed network of cities, perhaps hub and satellite cities, interconnected for human experiences, with each city center serving unique and distinguished roles in the human experience. And then finally, the potential for transportation to take on a larger role in the establishment of these ecosystemic networks of resilient, robust city centers, basically rebalancing the physical distribution of the human experience. Fascinating considerations, Tom. Thank you.
My absolute pleasure. Really enjoy it.
Vic, your thoughts?
So yeah, I was just saying, your thoughts resonate with mine, Diane, on the takeaways from what Tom said. The new role for transportation seems to be coming through, and we need to not think about it in the context of the present city, but this future connected city with an ecosystem of services where we could have these distributed networks, people working asynchronously. So how does transportation play a role in this new mode of trying to tailor our cities towards mental health, towards the well-being of the citizens, providing access to people? And the other thing that came through was the role of government and foresight. So having that 30-plus year time horizon to think about impacts on people and equity and other aspects that maybe the private sector is not able to think about, and also including a broader set of stakeholders.
Yeah, so right, Vic. Really important as these technology is unlocking new designs and new models, it's also helping us to rethink basically the strengths and the natural roles of the different actors in the broader ecosystem. So I think there's so much here that we have to think about and to continue to discuss. But for today, I think we need to wrap up. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your perspectives. Before we wrap, is there one piece of advice that you would like to share with our listeners for them to take away from this discussion?
It's just the importance of thinking about the future. I try to get all of my clients to carve out 1% of their time to focus on the future. One day every 6 months, whether you're doing it for yourself, for your career, or for your organization, take that one day every 6 months to think about the future in a structured fashion, about what's next over the next 2, 5, 7, 10 years. It is invaluable, and I wish more of us did it as individuals, and I wish more of our organizations did it too.
I love that. Obviously, we agree with you as we really focus in on those ecosystemic futures. We completely agree, Tom. The future is coming at us faster than ever. And with a more connected world that we're all operating in and living in, we all have to think about the implications of our decisions and actions in order to ensure that the future that we create together is one that has the greatest beneficial outcomes for all. So thank you so much for joining us today, both Vic and Tom. And for our audience, please join us for future episodes where we explore technological advances and structural patterns that will help us better innovate, operate, and navigate in our increasingly connected world. Please subscribe to this podcast and you can learn more at shoshaworks.com.